Station number 13717, Lieutenant Colonel Charles G. Reel 7.
Lieutenant Colonel G, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about Bradford's reconnaissance of the front line, I think early November or late October, in the Hooters Forest area at Eves.
He went up to see what the situation was, and he realised that if he obeyed orders literally and took all that Deborah into that exact area, the front people would have to be there, of course. They were in front of the German barrage. But the others would just be lying in path of shells. And so he hid 200 in a wood, not very far away, but reasonably safe. And that's the sort of thing he generally would do. And headquarters was in a huge concrete thing built by the Germans with three or four tin huts inside it, and we were there for about four days.
Was that Egypt Farm?
Egypt Farm or Egypt House. Inside there were a number of bays, and we fed them and slept in them, and I worked in, and we were there 4 days, and I used to work and write with a gas helmet on until I couldn't see, and then take it off and go on working until I couldn't see and put it on again. There was mustard gas about all the time, all day and all night.
How did it affect you, the mustard gas?
It didn't affect me.
The helmet worked?
Yes.
What was it like wearing a helmet for so
long? Oh, hot and stuffy, and after a bit you couldn't see straight, so you took it off.
Why couldn't you see straight?
The things fogged up, I think, and it was not quite all the time, but a good lot of the time.
What about ordinary shelling? Was there a lot of that on the?
The German barrage came down in front of Egypt House about five times a day without any showing the Germans were really frightened of an attack. I think, and it cost them millions of pounds, and mud poured up in the air, backwards and forwards, and they cut the telephone lines, and they should go on for 3 or 4 minutes, and then the Germans realised there was no attack and stop, and it happened several times a day.
But they didn't actually shell the pillbox that you were.
Well, it wouldn't matter; it would bounce off. Except that there was a door; it could have come in.
Did shells hit the pillbox?
No, not when I was there.
Were the doors pointing the wrong way?
Yes, it was pointing the wrong way, but there was a lot on top, and there was a passage inside the door. The one entertaining episode was the intelligence officer was outside one day. It was a German aeroplane firing low, and he suddenly rushed and said, "My God, that bloody man's fired at me. Give me a rifle." Got a rifle, went down and shot it down. I had to signal to the whole army, intelligence officer, snipers, shot down a German aeroplane, which was firing at him.
And that's an amazing
shot. That's a plumber person that comes there.
That actually happened?
Yes. And it happened very nearby. But we had most complicated arrangements about rations. It had to be done up in sandbags, and the companies had all sort of two in one and four in another, and this and that.
Would you company help organise that? Or the quartermaster?
The information went back that it had to be so many of the rations had to be sort of two in a bag and three in a bag and labelled.
And it went back to your wagon lines?
Wagon lines.
And you provided your own carrying parties, did you?
Yes, the quartermaster did that. We came up with mules as far as possible.
Was that an innovation? It seems to suggest it was in the book, but I've heard of that before. Was it an innovation?
Well, it was impossible there because a lot of the thing was duckboard. But as far as it could come up by transport, it came from the wagon lines, and then the companies presumably sent somebody to a Greek Point and took over these. Because the last night we were there, I think it was the last night or the night the colonel was wounded, they got to headquarters, and there they were, just behind Egypt House, which was, in a sense, safe. But we had to show a light to see which, of some kind.
The mules had got up to Egypt House, you mean? The mules had got up to, or the carrying part?
The sandbags with the food in had got in a dump just behind Egypt House. And the colonel walked by and said, "What's happened?" And I said, "Oh, well, you'll get it right." I was surprised he wasn't fed up, but he was wounded and going in. He said, "You get it done," and then we got it done, and I got to the right place, and I went in and found him mopping his face with a wound.
Yeah, he was wounded, and how did that happen? Did you know what happened?
Well, yes, the book's got it right. He was talking to a company commander up in the front, and the company commander got a bullet hit his helmet, and a piece of the helmet got chipped off and hit the colonel somewhere on the side of the face.
So, how bad was it? I mean, would it have normally sent? Was that the first wound he'd had while you were with them?
Yes.
And how bad was it, would you say?
Not very bad, no.
So, it would have been normal for a man to carry on with that, as opposed to some of his other wounds?
Well, he ought really, I suppose, to have had anti-tetanus injection. He may have, I don't know.
Now, was that the day you also found he was promoted? Was it the same?
I think it was the same day. As the thing came, he wouldn't do so, and I gave it to him. He said, "I don't want to go."
You took the message?
Yes, I took the message into him, and he said, "I won't go," and I said, "Read it again, sir. It's an order, it's not do you want to." And he was very sad at the thing. Half of him must have been delighted at being promoted, because he obviously was fit for it and trained for it, and he'd commanded the brigade several times, and when he got a VC, he was commanding two battalions at least. And
did his mood change?
Gradually a bit, I think. He realized he'd have to go, and began to think what he ought to do before he went, because I think it was that night, because I think we were relieved the next night. I think it was that night when he suddenly said, "You know, well, plumber, you told me." And I told him some story about plumber helping the gunners. He said, "Can you write that up to put him in for an MC?" And I said, "Yes, certainly," and did. And so that night he signed it, and plumber got his MC.
That was when plumber had done what?
He'd been intelligence officer for the whole year, and very hard worked and very dangerous work, a lot of it, bringing rations up, and he must have been very good at, trained by Bradford to have all these men alert, etc. We've done.
So it was a reward for his good service?
Yes. And under heavy fire, very dangerous, helping guns in the move in the mud under fire at night. He had an awful time.
Now, what else did he do before he left?
He wrote me a marvellous letter, which I thought would get me a job anywhere, but I seem to have lost it. I suppose it said, "Thank you for loyal service," and presumably intelligence or trying to help or something. But it was a very nice letter that I was very thrilled with, and so he must have written some others to other people too, presumably.
Did he speak to any of the officers before he left?
Not particularly. The book says that he gave an address to the battalion, but I have forgotten that. I must have been present if he did.
But you have no memories of what he said?
No.
Now, just a couple more points. Again, picked up from the book, yeah. The Bradford book. One thing that comes across it is that he didn't like women much, you know, that he had a respect for women, but he didn't have much to do with them.
He had anything much to do with them. They had a sister, and he wasn't like me. He was, you know, completely ignorant of them altogether. But I don't know that it's actually, I think, he sympathized with the men wanting a woman in Amiens as they went. Anything to keep the men better.
But there was no trace that he was a homosexual?
Oh, no. And not a trace of that.
And was he ever... I mean, because you knew him well. He was only a very young man.
Very young man.
Was there any trace, looking back or at the time, of him being young and silly? Because 24-year-old, 25-year-old men are often young and silly, irrational.
I can't think of one. I can't think of one. I think he was. He'd like to be a corkabout, that sort of thing. I think he realized that he had the ability and was conscious of that.
And so he was very sensible.
Yes. He was worried. I think I told you he was worried. I mean, if the war ended, he'd have been nothing.
Back to a lieutenant.
I imagine the brevet he got was a reward for something.
You said he had a fair temper. How bad was his temper?
He ticked me off once or twice pretty savagely. But with this deserter, I think I told you about, he was really frightening to him. I think he deserted to Runson. But I said, well, I wanted him to. But I mean, really, I'll shoot you with my own hand, that sort of thing.
Very aggressive.
Very aggressive. Very frightening. He could be. Wasn't normally.
It was an intensity you were portraying there.
I think it came out from his zest for perfection, and he wanted to frighten the person.
That was when he lost his temper with the deserter. When he lost his, you know, was a bit irritable with you. Would it last long?
No time at all.
And he didn't swear.
No, I don't think so.
So he'd just shout at you and then move on to the next matter.
Yes.
And there's no trace of sulkiness about it?
No trace at all. All was friendly, off parade. And I fortunately was as well, and I talked a lot, and there were always many in the mess, and it was always chatty and nice.
What would you talk to them about?
That's what I can't remember. My brother came to see me once or twice, and Colonel talked to him nicely and so on. Because the Colonel knew, my brother's Colonel. Was a dad.
Did any of his brothers ever visit? I mean, one of them was dead.
One was dead, and the other one, I suppose, was in France, but I don't know. And one was in the Navy, you see.
Now, who was responsible, as far as you know, for the book? Was that his other surviving brother that wrote the
book? Must have been.
You don't know for certain, though.
No, I don't know for certain.
Because there was a question, the museum was saying that they didn't know whether the last brother wrote it, the one who survived, whose name...
I don't know.
Or whether he commissioned it from someone.
He may have commissioned it. I think that's more likely, because he ought to have got in touch with me. May have been Mrs. Creamer, the sister, that got in touch. As they realized his fame, or the family fame, was well known.
But nobody ever did get in touch with you about in the writing of that book.
Oh, no.
Right, so when he left, I think it was 4th of November 1917.
Yes, like that.
And so as far as you don't remember this talking to the men, he just went then without much fuss at all, as far as you're concerned.
As far as I'm concerned, he just went.
And who took over? Well, that would be Crouch, wouldn't it?
Yes, must have taken over. He didn't come up to the front line to take over. I'm sure he didn't. I doubt if he could have got there. But certainly didn't. And the next thing I remember is Christmas.
Christmas the same year. Now, what I wanted to ask, when he went off to command a brigade in the 62nd
yes.
Division. And he didn't last long because he was killed.
He addressed the brigade, and they wrote his name on the villages they captured. Wick Bradford. Wick meaning Yorkshire for well done Bradford, or brave man, or something. Compliment. But they astonishing as he was, they knew his name. They felt they were fighting for him, and he must have talked to them as Montgomery talked to troops.
But he was killed in at the back end of November, wasn't he?
Yes.
Did you hear how he was killed, or did you know how he was killed? Because it's apparently not entirely clear.
I went to the we were moved to that division the next year, and my impression is, it's going ahead a little, the various senior officers, such as brigadiers in charge of gunnery, were so impressed by his knowledge of gunnery that they were wanted to resign their jobs and serve under him in any capacity he'd have them. Several of the staff. That's the story I was told.
And did you hear how he died?
Yes, a casual shell somewhere. They must have retired a good bit by then, I think. And goes out after that to somewhere not far away. He was found dead. And I think his watch and things like that had been stolen. Somebody had stolen.
Who told you that?
I don't know. Somebody, presumably, in the next... in the division we went
to.
Did
you get the news of his death in November, you know, as it happened in your battalion in the 9th? Were you aware he died?
Well, I didn't get the news quickly, no. I would get the news before Christmas, I should think. That's
what was your reaction when you heard?
Tragedy. Awful pity.
Did it upset you because he was dead as a man, or dead as a potential, or both?
I think both. I think I was one of the people who almost sort of worshipped him. Anyway, my wife was going to call her son that, rather than if we'd had one.
You thought that much of him?
Yes.
How did Crouch react when he heard?
I don't know. And I wouldn't know that. I didn't know him well then at all.
Apparently there's some talk that there was another... It was announced on parade to the battalion that Crouch made a speech to the battalion. Do you have any remembrance of that?
No, I don't remember that.
Now, so you, leaving Bradford behind now, in a sense, we move on. Now, between November, December, you carried on as adjutant.
To Crouch.
And what was Crouch like to work with?
Well, he was elderly. And
about how old? Because elderly means different things at different
times. Well, he fought in the Boer War and been wounded. So
would he be about 50 or young?
I talk a total tale, because when you're young yourself, 20, anybody that's over 30 is elderly. But he must, this is 1917, nearly 18. He must have been over 40 anyway, and big, wide, sergeant major type of person with long, bristly moustache. And of course, there's a photograph of him of any size in that book if you wanted one.
What was he like to work with after Bradford?
Well, he'd been old room sergeant, and he'd been a soldier in mounted infantry in the Boer War. I don't suppose he knew much about anything except keeping an orderly room going and how a battalion worked and a bit of drill. I don't suppose he'd ever studied anything.
Was it a big difference from Bradford then, who knew?
Well, enormous difference, yes, but of course I wasn't quite so inexperienced. I can't remember. Next thing I can remember is Christmas dinner, and I can't remember who made the buck of it, except that we had almost nothing in the way of drink. I wasn't doing the mess then, I don't think. In any case, we hadn't any vehicles to go and get it, go anywhere, and we were just behind the canal, nearly safe, but only just mud, but quite near, not very far away from a town, and all I can remember we had to drink was some sticky liqueur. I don't think I drank it, but an officer got drunk with it anyway, and so drunk that he couldn't be woken until about four the next day. He might have killed himself, but some idiot filled up his glass when he wasn't looking.
Now, Crouch, you implied earlier, had a very different attitude to drink to Bradford. Yeah, whereas
yes.
Bradford actually discouraged it as much as possible.
Yes.
Crouch couldn't get up sometimes, he said, with drink.
Well, he couldn't ever get up night. His servant used to wake him in the morning. And I don't think he ever got up in the night.
And that was because of drink?
Well, yes, he was asked to drink to put him to sleep.
Did he drink a lot, would you say?
No, he didn't drink a lot. Once in Germany, for no particular reason, he and an American doctor we had got together, and they drank everything they could find. And they got properly drunk, couldn't be woken until late afternoon. But the interesting thing about that was, it was the parson's house, and we had a cloth on it, a big square table that six or eight of us had supper on, with a cloth on it and an oil lamp. And in the morning when the servants went in, oil lamp was there, still lit, cloth had disappeared, and all the whiskey had gone. That would be quite a lot of half bottles and things.
But he didn't do that in the line in
1970? Oh, no. No, he never did that.
So when you say he couldn't be woken in the morning, it's not because he was blind drunk, it's because just because he was elderly and he'd had one or two drunks.
Yes.
And he couldn't wake up. But he wasn't what you'd call a drunk.
Well, we could have woken him. He wasn't at all a drunk. But this time, the interesting thing, he had a room next door about as big as this, and the cloth was missing. He went to bed with a cloth round him, but all his clothes were immaculately in a straight line across the floor, all beautifully folded. Went back to boyhood, going to the army first, folding his clothes. It must have been an incredible sight. I don't know whether I saw it or had it described to me.
Now, in that, you don't remember much between, you know, in the 4 weeks up to Christmas, but was the work you were doing any different? You've described your work as adjutant.
No, just the same. That's the same.
Would Crouch go round the men as Bradford had done, though?
Well, we went in the line, I don't think. I think we were out for a rest. But he would go round the men by day, because he wouldn't be doing anything else. He'd be doing a little bit of order of work normally.
Did he work as hard as Bradford had?
No. Oh, no. Just...
Was he still a good officer, though?
Yes. So I'll give him a lot of praise before we finished.
So it was in comparison to Bradford only that he appeared a lesser colonel.
Yes.
In front of other colonels, he was perhaps a bit of a good colonel.
Yes, very good later. But we were moved with him in charge. I remember being in a tent. We were in tents on the Ypres Menin Road, not very near a churchyard. Deep down, snow on the ground, and life was quite warm in the tent somehow. And dug down, I felt safe except for a direct hit. But there wouldn't be much shedding of that rain, it was so far from the front. And then the next thing I remember clearly is going up in frost to the front, very near Patterndale, which had been taken by the Canadians by then, going up across, where we were told to take 4 days' rations up with us. And of course we didn't, we took up our own. But 4 days' rations with us. Only after the third night, the colonel of the, I think it was the 6th Battalion, came in and said, "How have you been doing? And how are they doing for food?" "Oh, it's all right, we're having our rations sent up transport lines." And I stupidly let them take up 4 days' rations, and of course they dumped some and have eaten the rest. And I solved that by saying, "I've got a big dump of rations just outside. I had to take over in the dark, and I saw they'd been opened and some stolen. We get 600 rations out of there quite easily." I signed for them, unchecked, opened, but unchecked. So that happened. The other memory I have of...
So you lent them, you gave them the 6th Battalion?
Yes, 600
rations. Rations from your dump?
Yes. And I don't know how he took them, because he sent some people for them. The other thing I remember is with Crouch being taking over a dugout that was about 4 feet of water in it with duck boards. And he was fat and I was thin and small, but he had an awful job to crawl in through the door, because that was the height of the water, you see. Then he closed the door. It's only about only about one night we were there. And the other thing I remember is, it must have been January, with frost on the ground, we were holding the actual ridge at Passchendaele. And we could see over the other side, and the men had very strict orders that anybody who got trench feet would be court-martialed, because the cure for it was to take your socks, boots and socks off, and get your feet rubbed for an hour a day, each foot. The men had to be paired off for it, and it was done. One man got a very slight amount of trench fever and nothing happened. But the exciting thing is, we had a man deserted to the enemy. He'd been, a month or so before, out of the line. He'd not gone on parade. I mean, you say, I'm not going on a parade today, or it wasn't an important parade at all. And he got court-martialed, and he was charged wrongly. He was charged with repeatedly disobeying an order, and we couldn't prove that he'd had more than one order. We could prove he'd had an order, but the company sergeant, the major or something, had gone and said, come on, Jack, come on, or whatever his name was, get on, you're much better, and so on, without giving a flat order or a warning that he'd be. And so he was, and he felt it. He was unpopular with the other men, and he ran over to the enemy in the dark, and his corporal, or whoever, yes, corporal, I think, was given 28 days for not shooting him.
His corporal had seen him do it?
Yeah, seen him running over. And he got thrown in a duck pond after the war, I was told later.
He got what?
Thrown in a duck pond.
And he went back home?
I was back home later.
Do you know his name?
I don't know his name. But he wasn't. The other thing relative to the time at Ypres under Bradford was that 10 people deserted from carrying things up to the line. They were all people that had been 2 years without leave, and they were all caught, and they all got court-martialed, and they all were found guilty. And some poop of a general thought the discipline of this battalion is bad. I think we did this before. Somebody ought to be shot. And then somebody had the sense to see that he oughtn't to be shot. But we were frightened of it, because it's a nasty business. And of course, earlier in the war, there were a lot of people shot for desertion, and no doubt a lot deserved it. In any case, some of it had to be done. So the other thing I remember about holding the ridge is that our men, when the colonel came over and said his men had held rations, we answered, our men get a hot drink as soon as it's dark, they get a full lunch in the middle of the night, and another hot drink just before light. Brought up, we had those things that keep drinks hot for an hour. And the other thing I can remember is that we all agreed that some shells of the Germans coming over the ridge bounced on the ridge, or they touched the ridge, grazed the ridge, and went off making a funny noise. It happened quite often, but there wasn't then any serious danger, because the Germans weren't likely to attack.
How did you manage? And you were in this flooded dugout. That was there, was it? How did you manage? I mean,
you couldn't write it. It was just lived. Got up in the morning and I don't know. It was fairly safe to walk about because we were just holding the tip of the ridge, you see. The Germans couldn't see us.
So you wouldn't work in the flooded dugout?
I couldn't work like that, no. I can't remember whether there would be any writing there, probably.
How did you get on with Crouch then? Because you were completely different types, really.
Completely different, yes. And I have already said he had a slight two or three episodes that put him off me, but we got on quietly together. When we, somewhere very fairly early in the new year, we went to the 62nd Division, and we heard.
How did you feel about that? Because the 50th Division was Northern Division.
Because we reckoned that we were far the best battalion in the division, and we didn't want to be made pioneers.
Because you were made pioneers, yes, when you went to 62nd, weren't you?
We made pioneers, and we felt that was